Good morning. It is Kale and Company live here on WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com for this Wednesday morning. We are delighted to have you with us, and we are presented by Northeast Delta Dental. Northeast Delta Dental has individual and family plans designed to fit your lifestyle. Learn more and find your plan at DeltaDentalCoversMe.com. And we are delighted to have with us on this Wednesday, Dr. John Berger. Dr. Berger, we welcome you to the program.
Thank you very much, Ken. It's a pleasure to be here with you and your listeners.
Well, thank you for being with us out on the West Coast and getting up early to do this one. Dr. Berger is a senior research fellow at the Pacific Institute, a graduate of Stanford and the University of California. He's written over 100 articles on climate change and transitioning to clean energy. His new book is Solving the Climate Crisis, Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth. And Dr. Berger, first of all, of course, we celebrated Earth Day earlier this week. It's 54th anniversary. When did your interest in the topic begin?
Well, my interest in clean energy, which is inextricably connected to climate change, started in the 1970s when I began writing about the risks of nuclear energy. And I, at that point, became interested in what the alternatives to nuclear energy were. And that's when I began writing about and investigating clean energy alternatives like solar energy, wind power, geothermal power, hydropower, and also energy efficiency as a resource. It's actually our largest potential energy resource that's economically competitive and advantageous. So it began back in the 1970s.
In your book, we're told that we are wasting a lot of energy. About 30 to 50% of the energy used in buildings today. How do we go about starting to fix that?
We have to, first of all, fix that in existing buildings by improving the insulation, by improving the windows, by improving the heating systems and the cooling systems and the appliances, making sure that everything is maximally efficient and electrified, because when we use electricity, we save a great deal of energy. When we use combustion, that causes two-thirds of the energy to be wasted as heat, and therefore we can do a much better job by using electrical systems than by using combustion systems, and that goes for machineries, and it goes for machinery and for propelling vehicles as well. And for heat, an electric heat pump has what's known as the coefficient of performance of 3 to 5 times what the energy requirement is. So it mines free energy, basically, from the soil or from groundwater or from the air, and it can import it into the building. And also the same system can be used in reverse to cool. So it's a more economical way of providing for heating and cooling. In addition, there are other systems that should be applied to new buildings so that the new building from the get-go is made highly energy efficient and wastes very little energy, because our current building stock of about 111 million buildings of all kinds is very leaky, and a great deal of energy is just wasted in energy that's flowing through the walls or through cracks or around doors and windows, or through the windows themselves. So we can fix that. And by having building codes that are very stringent in terms of energy use, and also that mandate the use of clean power for new buildings, we can thereby save enormous amounts of energy that is now being wasted. 70% of our electricity is now consumed in buildings. However, much of that is produced by burning fossil fuels in a power plant. And when you do that, as I said earlier, two-thirds of the energy in the fuel is simply wasted as waste heat. So it's more efficient to generate your electricity from solar and wind, where the fuel is free, sustainable, and everlasting, and then not have that heat wasted, and provide your power efficiently. Incidentally, the solar and wind power provided by our current generation of renewable energy systems is a lot cheaper than power from coal or power from natural gas. And in addition, it comes with the benefits of not causing all of the air pollution and other devastating environmental effects of climate change and environmental damage to air and water.
There are some people that might say, well, are solar and wind really a practical way of heating our society and keeping our energy at the level it should be? Is it practical in all parts of this country?
Absolutely. Those were concerns 20 years ago, but we have put those concerns to rest, absolutely. And if you want to find out more about that, I go into it chapter and verse in Solving the Climate Crisis. But the short answer is that we have far more clean power resources than we need to generate the electricity in the United States several times over. And in addition, concerns have existed in the past about the fact that renewable power is intermittent and therefore was perceived as unreliable. But as they say, there's an app for that, and that app is energy storage. Battery costs have fallen by 90% in the past 10 years, and they are continuing to fall. So we have large amounts of economical battery storage capacity, and it's already working commercially in California, where earlier this month, all of the state's power in the evening hours was just produced from battery storage with no need for new generation. Mm. That's just one example. In addition, batteries are not the cheapest way of storing energy. We have other methods for storing the potential energy in falling water, and that's a whole system called pump storage. There's also gravitational energy storage, et cetera. But apart from that type of storage, we can also use something called a virtual power plant, in which this gets a little bit wonky, and I apologize in advance, Ken.
It's okay.
But because we can modify the demand of customers who volunteer for preferential rates and then allow us to postpone their use of energy to a more propitious time, we can manipulate demand on the grid and thereby reduce it and reduce the strain on all types of energy resources that are in play. I'm not sure I completely locked horns with all aspects of your question, and if I didn't, please come back at me.
Well, you do in your book talk about a transition to rapid clean energy, and how do we as a country pay for that?
That's a very, very basic question, because although the operating costs and the life cycle costs of clean energy are much cheaper than the cost of comparable fossil fuel systems, we have to come up with that front-end money. And the way to do that is through public-private partnerships, in which, let's say, the federal government provides 3 cents on the dollar in the form of a loan or an interest rate buy-down, and the private sector provides 97%. Of the capital, or 95%. But basically, for pennies on the dollar, we can get huge amounts of private money engaged in this process. And the way to understand this is to think about what interest rates mean to a project developer who wants to build a solar power project and sees before him on his spreadsheet interest rate costs of maybe 7% or 9%. Well, the project may look infeasible economically, but if somebody comes along and, as I said, buys down the interest rate and provides the capital so that the interest charge is not 7 or 9%, but maybe it's 2 or 3%, the project suddenly becomes extremely attractive. And we have trillions of dollars of private capital sitting on the sidelines that we would be delighted to come in when they have a virtually guaranteed rate of return. So that's one way that we can fund. But another thing that we can do, which makes even, well, as much sense, is that we've got to stop wasting money on things that are harmful to the earth and harmful to our economy. By that I mean, currently, we are subsidizing the fossil fuel industry with explicit and implicit subsidies to the tune of about $646 billion a year in the United States with taxpayer money and with damages to the environment that is a public good. So we need to stop that because it makes no sense to subsidize a mature and multi-trillion dollar industry. Why are we doing this? Well, it's because of the political power and the economic power of the fossil fuel industry. But we have to turn that fire hose of money around, and we have to use it to accelerate the clean energy transition, which, not coincidentally, would be hugely beneficial to the economy and would unlock trillions of dollars in savings and create millions of new good-paying jobs and literally save millions of lives and species while protecting public health and the democracy that we have and the environment. So, A, that's good news, and it shows that we could have like a quintuple bottom line benefit by doing it. One last point. Maybe two, if you'll indulge me again.
Sure. I'll tell you what. Can I jump in here? Because we have to take a quick break.
Sure.
We'll come back and talk about that.
Sure.
That one last point. Dr. John Berger with us, author of Solving the Climate Crisis, Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth. We will be right back. Kale and Company Live, WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, presented by Northeast Delta Dental. Welcome back, Kale and Company Live, WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, presented by Northeast Delta Dental. Our guest is Dr. John Berger, author of Solving the Climate Crisis, Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth. And we had to go to commercial before. Dr. Berger, you were going to make one final point on how we can begin to turn things around here in this country.
Yeah, I was addressing the question of how we finance this clean energy transition. And I mentioned that one thing we ought to do is rechannel this flood of money that's going to the fossil fuel industry and turn it around and spend that money accelerating the clean energy transition, because there are so many benefits, which I had previously enumerated before the break. And we currently spend about $1 trillion in the United States on fossil fuels of all kinds, coal, oil, and natural gas. As we make the economy more efficient, and as I pointed out earlier, we're wasting about half of the energy that we use in this country, that liberates $500 billion, which could be directed toward clean energy and the clean transition. We also are causing a phenomenal amount of damage to the economy and the environment by our reliance on fossil fuels for 80% of our energy. Globally, 7.5 to 8 million people are killed every year outright by air pollution, 90% of which is produced by the fossil fuel combustion that we are engaged in. So if you put a few million dollars value on a human life, clearly that's trillions of dollars that are being caused in terms of damages. And then there are hundreds of millions of people, in addition to the premature deaths, who suffer from illnesses that are related to air pollution. And then there's all the damage from extreme weather and wildfires and hurricanes and 500-year rainfall events and whatever. So that's why the Potsdam Institute has calculated that by 2050, we will be causing $38 trillion in environmental and other economic damage as a result of our reliance on fossil fuel. So I think we have to turn money around and spend it on getting to 100% clean energy economy as quickly as we possibly can.
You know, as you well know, I'm sure most people are generally impatient. So how long would a turnaround like you propose take?
Well, the turnaround to a clean electrical system could easily be done in 10 years, but the turnaround for the entire economy will take longer because we have legacy investments, and some of these investments are very difficult to replace, and we have obstacles in terms of the political and economic power of the fossil fuel industry and the fact that there's a lot of public interest, public confusion about the clean transition, which has divided the electorate and made for deep schisms, so that the policies that we need to really expedite this transition and do it quickly have not materialized. We have a political system that's heavily influenced by dark money, and there's de facto bribery via lobbying and so forth. And then we have a sort of fragmentation in the electorate due to the fact that, A, there's sort of disinformation going on all the time in the background, and then we have extreme income inequality, which is not unrelated to the dark money. So I can't answer your question about how long it's going to take. It depends on how long it takes us to overcome our public confusion and misconceptions about the costs and benefits of the clean transition.
What are some of the myths that are out there about climate change that you are trying to dispel?
Well, the most common myth, perhaps, is that climate change is natural, it's cyclical, and that we are not responsible. I wrote a book a little over 10 years ago called Climate Myth, the Campaign Against Climate Science. One has to read reliable sources to understand the answers and to convince oneself that we are responsible and that we are the cause of disrupting the climate. It sounds mind-boggling, but is actually true and has been verified by hundreds of millions, if not more, scientific observations and by the work of thousands of highly qualified, trained scientists with PhDs in climatology and PhDs in geophysics who know more than I do about the climate by orders of magnitude. So we have to make sure that we take our information from reliable sources, not from somebody who maybe doesn't understand the scientific method and is trolling on the internet and making wild, unfounded claims that sound plausible if you don't look into them. But look at reliable sources, scientific sources, and then draw your own conclusions.
We only have a couple of minutes left, unfortunately, because we could talk a long while about this. But I wanted to touch on transportation, which you mentioned in the book. When it comes to transportation, what are some of the green solutions that we could look for?
The main thing is that we have to electrify our transportation across the board. Cars, trucks, trains, buses, even aircraft. Ships, all of these modes of conveyance can all be electrified, and the costs of electric transportation are falling very rapidly. I mentioned earlier battery costs have fallen by tenfold in the past, by 90% in the past 10 years. And in addition, we have new battery technologies that are coming along that within 4 or 5 years, certainly, will be widely available commercially with 50% more energy density than we have in our current generation of batteries. You'll be able to get a 100-mile charge inside of 3 minutes, and the high-end electric vehicle will go 700 miles on a charge, which actually nobody really needs. And medium-range electric vehicles will go 400 miles, let's say, more than adequate for all average use. In addition, when you go to the showroom, you'll find that the electric vehicle sticker price is going to be lower than the internal combustion engine price, and your electric power to run the car is going to be cheaper than gasoline and diesel. It already is, and the life cycle costs are going to be lower. They already are, and the fueling costs and the maintenance costs are going to be lower. So it's going to be a win-win and a huge incentive for buyers of electric vehicles and light trucks. And it's kind of technical quickly to talk about how to convert the heavier trucks and ships and planes and so forth. And for that information, I would refer people to Solving the Climate Crisis. And I go into great detail about that in every area of transportation and also the economy.
Well, it's a terrific book, should be read by all who are certainly have a concern about our climate situation in the country. And Dr. John Berger, we appreciate you being with us today. Again, the book is Solving the Climate Crisis, Frontline Reports from the Race to Save the Earth. And thanks so much for getting up early to join us today.
My pleasure, Ken. Thank you very much for taking an interest in the topic.
All right. Thank you for writing the book. We appreciate it.
Okay.
All right. Take care. We'll be back. Kale and Company Live, WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. We are presented by Northeast Delta Dental. Talk a little NFL draft because it's just a little over 24 hours away. Maybe more like 36 hours away, but nonetheless, it'll be on Thursday, and we'll talk with Tom King, who's covered the Patriots for years and years, right here on WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, presented by Northeast Delta Dental. We'll be right back. And welcome back. It is Kale and Company Live here on WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com for this Wednesday morning. We are presented by Northeast Delta Dental, and now we are just one day away from the NFL draft. You've been hearing about it for months now. And joining us, Tom King of the Nashua Telegraph. Tom has covered the Patriots for longer than many people have been alive. How many years, Tom?
Let's see. I got to count. Can I count that high? I'm not sure. I'd say as steadily since 95. So it's almost 30 years.
There you go. All the Super Bowl wins and all the Super Bowl losses as well included. And Tom is with us today, and we're going to talk a little bit about the draft. And I'm just going to ask you the question. Are the Patriots going to trade it? The third pick?
I say no. I say they're going to hang in there at three, and they should take Drake May. I don't know it's hard to decipher between what's true and what's not, obviously, this time of year, Ken. But I really think the Commanders will take Daniels. And then that leaves May. May has such athletic prowess that it'd be really hard to pass up on him. It's one of the reasons why they got Jacoby Brissett to kind of steer the ship for a little bit before a guy like May is ready. But why you're hearing about all the disinterest in May, I think, is kind of floated out there because they want to see what they can get in a trade.
Yeah.
And so far, I don't think that they really had any big offers to do it, major offers. There are a lot of teams that want to move up, and it's going to be interesting.
Oh,
the draft starts with the Commanders.
Yep.
because you don't know. You know, you're not quite sure, but you figure they're going to take Daniels, but you're not sure. And then it gets really interesting going down because there are teams below them, below the Patriots, like the Giants, like Minnesota for sure, that want to move up. So if they're not able to move up with New England, they'll target Arizona and try. And then once they target Arizona, now you're talking probably, if the Patriots take May, you're talking about some of the quote-unquote lesser quarterbacks, like the J.J. McCarthy. I did a story last week, and it ran in our weekend print edition, and it's online, with Trevor Knight, the former UNH quarterback who is now the Draycott High School head coach, and also a runs his own quarterback school. And I said, okay, let's rate him. Go right down the line. All right, tell me who's good, who's bad, what you like, what you don't like, the whole bit. We probably were on the phone for about a half an hour. And the consensus is that if May is there and they don't take him, that the people in charge should be fired. So that was the consensus. And also the consensus is that two of the quarterbacks of the six that everybody talks about may not even make it in the NFL, and they'll only be backups at best.
Wow.
You know, yeah, there a guess as to who those two are?
I'm going to guess Penix and Nix.
No.
No?
Nix, yes. Penix, no. Penix is the most NFL-ready quarterback.
Really?
Yes.
Yep.
He is considered the most NFL-ready, older, sure, left-hander, two knee surgeries. That's the draw. If Penix didn't have those knee issues and maybe wasn't as old as he is, because I think he's 24, 25, if that weren't the case, he might be the number two or number three guy.
Wow.
So, but Penix is going to be good for somebody. But McCarthy is the other one that
really?
Trevor mentioned.
Really?
Yes, McCarthy wow. And Nick. As basically, you can't understand why the hype is going on about McCarthy because he hasn't really shown enough in college. So, well, you know, I mean, that's a quarterback talking about a quarterback. So,
yeah,
they, you know, but that's Patriots have it's, you know, it's funny. It you know, this is the most intriguing Patriots draft I think we've ever seen, right?
Since Bledsoe probably, but
I think since Bledsoe, because it was going to be Bledsoe or Meyer, right? Rick Meyer or Drew Bledsoe, and then I think the other one was when Belichick not his first draft, but his second draft when he took Richard Seymour.
Yeah.
Everybody wanted him to take that receiver that the Bears grabbed. So you know, these are it's going to be hard to see, but if you're not starting to hear by tomorrow of a mega package for the Patriots,
yeah,
I doubt it's going to happen. I think tomorrow's the cutoff for those huge packages, because that takes a lot of time and a lot of talking, and it would be really tough, I think. And if the Patriots are going to try to get that kind of a package, they better have another quarterback in their sights and better make it with a team where they think they can get that quarterback where they would end up picking. So, and I don't know if 11 is good enough. Well, that's where the Vikings are.
Yep.
The Giants, maybe. But see, the Giants, I don't think, want to give up a lot for a quarterback. I really don't, to try to move up. I just don't think they want to do that. They have so many holes to fill. They have two capable quarterbacks, you know, quote-unquote capable quarterbacks in Daniel Jones and Drew Lock. So I think that they'll probably sit still. If anything, they might trade down. Arizona is the other team you look at, because they'd probably be on target to get Marvin Harrison Jr.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is all conjecture. You never know until all it takes is one team to shake up the entire thing. It's like a domino, right? I mean, it's like you know, like Jenga. You know, you pull something out, boom, it all collapses.
Well, that's true.
I don't want to get drafted, Ken. I haven't been drafted.
Drafted. You've never even, well, you might have been Mr. Irrelevant at one time, but you've never been drafted.
I'm always Mr. Irrelevant, Ken. It's not one time. Every day I'm Mr. Irrelevant.
But at any rate, I mean, it could come as late as, you know, just before the third pick. You never know. You never know.
It would be hard to keep that a secret right before the third pick,
yeah,
if it was that big of an offer.
All right. Well, the question is, we've known who has made the decisions, you know, in the previous 20 or so years. But who's making the ultimate decision?
I think it's going to be, I think Jonathan Kraft is making the ultimate decision.
I think
the ownership. They're not doing the negotiating. All right. Elliot Wolf will give them his recommendation. But it's clear that the Crafts want to get a quarterback. You know, they're picking, you know, I just go 2-2. I add 2-2 here. You desperately need a quarterback, a young quarterback. That's what ownership wants. A young, highly touted quarterback in the draft. You're picking third. When are you ever going to have a better chance at getting one of the best quarterbacks in the draft than now?
Well, let's hope not, anyway.
You know?
Yeah.
That's it, right,
yeah.
Exactly. I mean, you hope that doesn't repeat itself.
Right.
But that's the scenario. You know, this is the highest they've ever picked since the Bledsoe pick.
Exactly,
so,
yeah.
You know, so, I mean, this is, you know, they weren't fooling around back then, and they probably shouldn't fool around right now.
You think this?
You know, don't forget,
yep,
everybody who says that, well, we can get this mega package and everything else, well, that's great. Remember, picking 34th, too. You're going to get a good player there to fill a hole here and there.
Yeah, so some are saying that Penix might make it to the second round.
He could. He very well could. But do you want to take that chance?
Probably not.
No, if you're New England, you can't take that chance. You're number three. Grab the quarterback. And the best athlete and the best quarterback, I believe, after Daniels and Caleb Williams,
yeah.
I think those, you know, even Daniels in May. Trevor Knight, when I talked to him, he had those two tied. They were both tied. Daniels scares me because I don't think that he's physically ready. I think he's smaller. I mean, he's thinner in stature. I don't know if he'd survive the rigors of the NFL for 17 games.
Tom King is with us. Tom, we have to take a quick break here and be back with more draft talk. Patriots have the number 3 pick overall right now anyway. And they have an opportunity here to grab what they hope will be a franchise quarterback. So we'll see how it plays out. Tom King from the Nashua Telegraph with us. We'll take a break. Kale and Company continues right here. WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, presented by Northeast Delta Dental, and we will be right back. Kale and Company live here on WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. Great to have you along with us. We are presented by Northeast Delta Dental, and we're talking NFL Draft. It's been the talk of every New England radio talk show now for months and months and months. Finally comes down to the big night on Thursday, and Tom King is with us, who has covered the Patriots for a long, long time. And Tom thinks that the Patriots will keep the number 3 pick, not trade down and get multiple picks, maybe a couple of NFL players in the deal. They will stick with number 3 and pick a quarterback. And you think their best pick would be Drake May out of North Carolina?
Yeah, I do. I just think that his athleticism is far and above some of the others. I think that he's, you know, obviously, there's highs and lows with Drake May. You know, I don't know if he would play right away. I think that they might have to sit him a little bit. let Jacoby Brissett run the ship, which is one of the reasons why they got Brissett. But all that will be ironed out in minicamp and OTAs and training camp. And, you know, then they'll know what they had. Let's harken back when they had Mac Jones and Cam Newton. They kind of knew what Newton's, you know, weaknesses were in terms of his limitations now, you know, with his arm, and he couldn't throw and everything else. So it was almost a no-brainer when Mac Jones got here that he was going to be able to play and probably end up playing right away. But with May, they may, you know, they could want to sit him a little bit just to get him acclimated and not rush a quarterback in the way they did with Mac Jones. Because that when they rushed Mac Jones, he had his best year. But, you know, that's they'll have to sort that out. You know, I think they got the right guy. Their offensive coordinator is going to be able to, he's a quarterback guy, and that's the best thing you can have is an offense, you know, with an offensive coordinator. So I think that's, everybody likes to say, oh, he's not good enough or whatever. He does, what has he done and everything else? You know, let them do their jobs. And, you know, I think that he's more of a teacher than anything else, and that's what they need right now at that spot. And, you know, I think he would benefit of Drake May very well. But that aside, there's all sorts of temptations and there's all sorts of different holes that they need to fill. They need offensive line help, although they did get some veteran depth in free agency. And here's the other thing, Ken. A lot of people are moaning and groaning about how they just didn't spend a lot of money in free agency with what they had. Free agency is not supposed to be the end-all, be-all. And if anyone thought that they were going to spend a ton of money after all the money they spent in the big spending spree of 2021, they were dreaming, because Robert Kraft does not want to spend that kind of money in free agency a lot. And given the fact that maybe they got a couple of good players out of that rush of spending rather than four or five, they weren't going to do that. He'd rather see them build through the draft.
Yep.
And, you know, they're picking high enough in every round to have the opportunity to get what they want, I think. And then they can move up and down and do those things. But I really hope they take the good athletic quarterback rather than the limited guy like J.J. McCarthy, who I don't care if J.J. McCarthy can manage a game and show leadership and all of that stuff. That's what Mac Jones was supposed to be, right? And that's what he was for a little bit of time. But it didn't get them anywhere. They need a guy who can really show a lot of ability and a lot of arm strength and a lot of ability to run and all sorts of different things. And May's got it. All he's got to do is learn how to do it at the NFL level.
But J.J. McCarthy played for Jim Harbaugh. He played at Michigan, national
Good.
Championship. They've had success.
Let Harbaugh pick him. I bet he won't.
They've had success with a Michigan quarterback before, so, you know.
That's true, and that's going to be the temptation. But the other thing is that when they had that success with the Michigan quarterback at the start, you know, Tom Brady was a game manager, and it worked because they ran the ball and they, you know, threw a lot to the tight ends and did a lot of things and that they weren't doing under Bledsoe. And that worked. This is a different NFL today. You know, this is a little bit of a lot different NFL. And I think that's one of the reasons why Bill Belichick isn't around anymore, is because he never really adapted to that offensively. Defensively, he did. And that always surprised me. If he knew what to do to stop these offenses on defense, why didn't he know enough to get enough of an offense to be able to give defenses a problem? And he wasn't able to do that the last 4 or 5 years. We'll see what happens. I'd be surprised if they trade down, but you know, you never know. But isn't it amazing, Ken, what you hear as the draft gets closer? The stories get, the rumors get wilder and wilder as you get closer.
Oh,
don't
sure,
they?
Of course.
I mean,
it's
unbelievable. One of my favorite movies is with Draft Day.
Yeah,
With Costner. That was one of my. favorite.
Oh, absolutely,
movies.
Yeah.
Because I think that's a lot of it, is that's how it is.
Yeah.
You know? It really is.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, it really is. It's crazy. I got to ask you, though, Tom, because you lived all of this in covering the Patriots for as long as you did. What was your take on the Dynasty, the series that was produced by the Kraft Company?
I only saw bits and pieces of it. Just don't have time to sit down there and watch the whole thing all the time. I mean, it's right now things are a lot busier for me than they used to be since I'm the only sports writer left at Nashua. But my take was, I mean, it was a Kraft production, and boy, did they really give Bill Belichick a hard time in that.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, that was one of my takes. We all knew that Tom Brady was young and brash and everything else and the whole bit. But, and that Bill was hard to play for. And when you got 53 guys and you're coaching 53 guys, you know, maybe 40, you know, 35 to 40 of them are going to hate your guts and the others are going to say, hey, this guy's great, you know. So, you know, I think that that was my impression hearing the clips. Going online and watching just a little bit of it here and there, it was just, boy, they really, it would have been hard to imagine Bill Belichick coming back to coach this year after what they were saying in that documentary.
Yeah. Well, obviously then, they knew he was gone because they wouldn't have been in the midst of producing this thing if he had any chance of staying around.
I had to think that was going to be the case, yes.
Yeah.
Unless all of a sudden he had a great year, right? And then what do you do?
They probably would have scrapped it, right?
They would have would have held it another year because I think their plan was to have Bill Belichick coach for 2 years.
Yeah.
This last year and this year, this coming year, and then they make a move and then retire or he would retire or whatever. They figured that if Bill Belichick was good and doing what. You know, and things were successful, he would break Shula's record by that point, and everything would be on course, and then they could say, Bill, it's time, we got to make, you know, this is what we want to do. So my guess is they wouldn't have scrapped the project, they just would have held it, right?
So
That's what they would have done. Yeah.
So why didn't Belichick get a job in the offseason?
Well, if you look at the openings, I don't think there was a real good fit for him. I think Atlanta was probably the best thing. But in Atlanta, the owner had a lot of guys there that had been worked there for years, including Rich McKay. Rich McKay and Bill Belichick don't get along. And one of them was going to have to go. I mean, McKay was going to have to go. So they all those people in the organization fought hard to keep Belichick out of there. Now, yes, Kraft was probably asked about Belichick, and knowing his relationship with the Atlanta owner, I would think that he probably would have told him. Yeah, well, he didn't tell him anything that we didn't know, right? The guy is hard to work with. He's, you know, he's arrogant. You know, blah blah blah, the whole bit. But one of the main reasons, Ken, is look at the last 4 years.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
You know, look at the last 4 years.
Yeah. The performance hasn't been good. The drafting hasn't been good. I mean, it's been a mess, as you know.
Right. Exactly. And I compare Belichick to Chuck Knoll and the situation where it was in Pittsburgh.
Right. Yeah.
They did that gracefully, but it was obvious that Knoll wasn't going to come back. But once your good players go and you don't replace them with good players, it's not easy.
That's the end of the road
there. And people forget that the Patriots went a long time between Super Bowl wins.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it was almost like the Jordan era in Chicago.
Exactly.
There was, you know, 3 years here and then 3 years there. You know what I mean?
I do.
And that's how it was.
Yeah. And Tom, unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap it up, but always fascinating. And we'll have to get you back because sometime after the draft and we'll do our best to analyze it.
Oh, that'd be great, Ken.
All right. No problem. All right.
I might be in the pool by then. You never know.
You probably will be. The last sports writer left in Nashua, New Hampshire, ladies and gentlemen, Tom King. Thank you.
No problem, Ken Kale. Thanks for having me.
All right, Tom King, and thanks to all of you for listening right here, WKXL, nhtalkradio.com. Have a great Wednesday, everybody.